Welcome back, Hemingway listeners, to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things. Today we're talking about Render Black, Book 1, Chapter 4. New character. What did you think of the aquiline-nosed Julian? excuse me. Swim said the Mama Fishy said, it seems that Julian is a bit of a Napoleon fanboy. Julian's favourite book, published in 1822 or 23, was a book by Comte Emmanuel de la Cases, Napoleon's chamberlain, and was a recounting of Napoleon's life in exile and the deposed emperor's oral history of his career. Epigraph, these precise words are not found in Machiavelli's work. Laura Weistich said, it is also said that Julian's only knowledge of history is the 1796 campaign in Italy. Our treat says, I feel bad for Julian. It doesn't sound as if he has a supportive household at all. In fact, it sounds pretty abusive, although I wonder how it compares to similar households of the time. I'm betting with his book learning and smarts, he will rise far above his father. Though he's so young and already has what seems like a plum offer for someone of his station. Yeah, pretty strict household there. But I had the same thought actually when reading it. I was like, is this just what life was like back then? Like, you know, you see it kind of mocked, especially in like comedies. I was watching, what's that? Miracle Workers, the Dark Ages one. A comedy show with Daniel Radcliffe and what's his name? I can't think of his name. Anyway, and there's this joke about how like you just inherit whatever job your parents have, no matter how crappy it is, and there's no room for any kind of exploration outside of that field. And they're just so, so narrow-minded, and it's kind of a running joke. Their surnames is the Shit Shovelers, and they've come from a long line of, you know, that's their profession, they shovel shit. Because it was before toilets, I suppose. And it has that, it makes me think, was that what it was just like back there? Like, there was just no scope to do anything beyond whatever simple task your family does. And so reading in books and learning something else is almost like, who do you think you are, kind of thing. What a horrible time to exist. That said, though, I'm sure even if it was like that, he's still got to be comparatively a mean father. Like, he's just straight up nasty. Starfall 15 says, I like this competition between Derenal and Valinod. I'm not sure if it even exists in regard to Sorel. Not sure if Valinod has requested the services of Sorel. I guess they spend their fortune outbidding themselves just for appearances. Sorel's introduction in the workplace, his nose in a book, summarizes his interests. His one question to his father was straight to the point and underlined his cleverness and ambition. His father didn't think of asking it, which made him angry at himself, and used any excuse to berate his least liked son. Definitely this chapter raised my interest and enjoyment in the book. Oh, I just made the link. Derenal wants a tutor for his child. I can't remember if it was daughter or son. I think it was daughter, actually. Because of a status thing. And he wants the son of the sawmill. And that is Julian, this book smart kid, who I was just saying has such small prospects. He just basically has to be a sawmiller. But I don't know if it's already happened or if it's about to happen, but he's going to have this new job opportunity to be the tutor for the mayor's child. There you go. I just made that link. How slow am I? Non-creative handle says, Julian reminds me of Belle from Beauty and the Beast. Fancies education and stimulating the mind, whereas the people around him think he's defective. I guess it's safe to say Julian is going to leave to be a tutor pretty soon. Yeah, everyone else connected the dots except for me. Techrific says, both Valenod and Monsieur de Renal apparently think highly of Julian Sorel's academic and priestly accomplishments. Not so for Sorel Sr. Although rich, he's perhaps not as clever as he thinks he is. I suppose he's disappointed in his son. He thinks him physically weak, and he's certainly a sensitive young man. Losing that book didn't make him lash out in anger, but made him cry, as the book was part of an inheritance from a man he seemed to have respected. Perhaps seen as more like a real father than Sorel Sr., the sentimental blow was understandably hard. I'm intrigued by Julian Sorel. Mission accomplished, Stendhal. Yeah, mission accomplished, Stendhal indeed. I'm intrigued as well. I just remembered that today I had a call on my computer and I had to adjust the volume of my microphone. And now that I've done that, that means there's probably going to be more background noise in tonight's episode. Maybe. Maybe not. Maybe it'll sound better. It sounds different though. That's why. I'll adjust it back for tomorrow's episode. Vocab. It probably sounds exactly the same. Vocab. Sutan definition. A priest's cassock. Okay, thanks for that. Terrific. And I can't remember what a cassock is, although I read that word every second a day. Full-length garment of single colour worn by a certain Christian clergy. Right, it's a bit of church wear. Nematode86 says, man, I love it when people treat other people as status symbols. I feel bad for Julian. Yeah. Don't feel too bad, though, because I think his luck's about to change. I think he's going to go and tutor the mayor's daughter and then fall in love with her, if I've, you know, read enough of the Hemingway list by now to predict how these things go, I would say that's what's going to happen. Although that would just be, like, too good, right? No, he gets a good job with good people, gets the girl. Then something awful's got to happen after that. All right, let's read the next chapter. It's called A Negotiation. It's quite long. About double the length of yesterday, so here we go. Cunct cuntando restituit rem. That's an ennuous quote. God knows what it means. We'll probably find out by tomorrow, though, if I know you guys. The chapter's called A Negotiation. Answer me without lying, if you can manage that, little dog of a reader. How do you know Mademoiselle de Renal? When have you spoken to her? I've never spoken to her, replied Julian. I've never seen the lady except at church. But you've stared at her, insolent villain. Never. You know that at church I only see God, Julian added, with a little hypocritical air, well adapted, he thought, to ward off further blows to the head. Anyway, there's something behind all this, replied the cunning peasant, and was silent for a moment. But I'll get nothing out of you, damn hypocrite. The fact is, I'll be rid of you, and my sawmill will be better for it. You've won over the curé, or someone, who has got you a fine job. Go, pack your bag, and I'll take you to Monsieur de Renal's place, where you're going to be a tutor to his children. What will I get for that? Food, clothes, and 300 francs in wages. I don't want to be a servant. Animal, who talked to you of being a servant? Would I want my son to be a servant? But with whom shall I be eating? This question disconcerted old Sorel. He felt that in talking more about it, he might commit some solecism. He worked himself up into a temper with Julian, covering him with insult and accusing him of greediness, and left him in order to consult with his other sons. Julian saw them shortly afterwards, each leaning on his axe in council. After having watched them for a long time, Julian, realizing that he could gather nothing from it, went to position himself on the other side of the saw so as to avoid being surprised. He wanted to think about this unexpected announcement which could alter the course of his life, but felt himself incapable of being sensible. His imagination was taken up entirely in picturing what he would encounter in Monsieur de Renal's beautiful house. It would be necessary to give up all that, he said to himself, rather than be reduced to eating with the servants. My father will want to force me to. I'd rather die. I've got 15 francs and 8 sous saved up, and I'll free myself tonight in 2 days by side paths where I needn't fear any gendarmes. I will be at Besançon. There I will enlist as a soldier, or, if necessary, cross into Switzerland. But then there will be no more getting on in the world for me, no more ambition, no more of that fine career in the priesthood which could lead anywhere. This horror of eating with the servants was not natural to Julian. To make his fortune he would have done far more painful things. He borrowed his repugnance from Rousseau's Confessions. It was the sole book through which his imagination formed any idea of the larger world. He collected bulletins of the Grand Army and the memorials of St. Helena, completed his Koran. He would have died for these three works. Never did he have faith in any other. Following the judgment of the old Surgeon Major, he saw all the rest of the books in the world as liars, written by scoundrels to gain advancement. Together with a soul of fire, Julian had one of those astonishing memories so often associated with stupidity. To win over the old Curé Chaland, on whom he clearly saw his lot in life did depend, he had learned by heart the whole of the Latin New Testament. He also knew Monsieur de Maistre's book, Du Papi, and believed in one as little as the other. As if by mutual agreement, Sorel and his son avoided talking to one another again that day. At dusk, Julian went to the curé's house for his lesson in theology, but he thought it wise not to mention the strange proposition that had been made to his father. "Perhaps it's a trap," he said to himself. "I must seem to have forgotten about it." Early next day, Monsieur de Renal summoned old Sorel, who, after having made him wait an hour or two, finally arrived at the door, making 100 excuses mixed up with as many respectful bows. By means of rehearsing all kinds of objections, Sorel gathered that his son would eat with the master and mistress of the house and, on the days that they had company, alone with the children in a room apart. More disposed to raise difficulties, the more he perceived a genuine urgency on the part of Monsieur Le Maire, and anyway brimming with mistrust and astonishment, Sorel demanded to see the room in which his son would sleep. It was a large and well-furnished room, but into it they were already busy carrying the three children's beds. This circumstance cast a shaft of light into the mind of the old peasant. With even more self-assurance, he demanded to see the clothes to be provided for his son. Monsieur de Renal opened his desk and took out 100 francs. "With this money, your son will go to Monsieur Durand, the draper, and get himself fitted out with a complete suit of black." "And even if I take him away from your house," said the peasant, who had suddenly forgotten his respectful manner, "he'll keep the suit?" "Doubtless." "Oh, all right," said Sorel in a drawling voice. "There's only one more thing remaining for us to agree on, the money you'll give him." "What?" cried Monsieur de Renal indignantly. "Yesterday we agreed that I will give him 300 francs. I think that's plenty, and probably too much." "It was what you offered, that I don't deny at all," said old Sorel, speaking ever more slowly, and by an effusion of genius which would only surprise those who don't know the French comptoirs peasantry. He added, looking fixedly at Monsieur de Renal, "We've found better elsewhere." At these words the mayor looked disconcerted. He controlled himself, however, and after a skilled debate lasting about a good 2 hours, in which not a word was said without calculation, the cunning of the peasant overbore the cunning of the rich man, who did not need it in order to live. All the many points which were to govern Julian's new existence were resolved. Not only was his salary fixed at 400 francs, but it was to be paid in advance on the first of each month. "Good, I'll send him 35 francs today," said Monsieur de Renal. "To make a round sum, a rich and generous man, such as that gentleman, our mayor," said the peasant, in a wheedling tone, "could go so far as to make it 36 francs. "Very well," said Monsieur de Renal, "but there's an end of it." For the moment, anger gave him a firm tone. The peasant saw that he must go no further. Then, in his turn, Monsieur de Renal began to make himself felt. He certainly would not give the first month 36 francs to old Sorel, who was very keen to receive it on his son's behalf. Monsieur de Renal had realized that he would have to recount the part he had played in the whole negotiation to his wife. "Hand me back the 100 francs I gave you," he said crossly. "Miss Monsieur Durand owes me something. I will go with your son and get him fitted out in black cloth." After this vigorous action, Sorel prudently returned to his deferential phrase making. This took up another quarter of an hour. Finally, seeing that he certainly had no more to gain, he took his leave. His last respectful flourish ended with these words, "I will send my son up to the chateau." It was thus that the mayor's underlings referred to his house when they wanted to please him. On returning to his mill, Sorel sought his son in vain. Mistrustful of what might happen, Julian had left in the middle of the night. He wanted to deposit his books and his cross of the Legion of Honour in a safe place. He had taken all of them to his friend Faucoux, a young wood merchant who lived on the high mountain that dominated Verrieres. When he reappeared, "God knows, you damn idler," his father said to him, "if you'll ever have enough decency to pay me for your food that I've been advancing you for so many years. Pack up your scraps and get off to his worship, the mayor's place." Julian, astonished not to have been beaten, made haste to go, but he was hardly out of sight of his terrible father when he slackened his pace. He decided that to go to the church to perform a station of the cross would be to use to his hypocrisy. That word surprises you. Before arriving at that ghastly notion, the young peasant's soul had had quite a course to run. In his early childhood, the sight of some dragoons of the 6th returning from Italy, wearing their long white cloaks and helmets with long black plumes on their heads, whom Julian had beheld tethering their horses to the grilled windows of their father's house, rendered him crazy for the life of a soldier. Later on, he listened with rapture to stories of the battles of the bridge at Lodi, of Arcoli, and of Rivoli, told him by the old surgeon major. He noticed the passionate looks the old man directed towards his cross. But when Julian was 14, they began to build a church at Verrieres, which could be called magnificent for so small a town. It had above all 4 marble columns, the sight of which impressed Julian. These became famous thereabouts because of the hatred they excited between the justice of the peace and that young ecclesiastic, the envoy from Besancon, who was supposed to be a spy for the congregation. The justice of the peace was on the point of losing his place, at least that was the local opinion, had he not dared to have a quarrel with a priest who nearly every fortnight travelled to Besancon, where they said he saw Monsieur the Bishop. In the midst of all this, the justice of the peace, father of a large family, pronounced several judgments which seemed unjust. All bore against those citizens who read the Constitutionnel. The right-thinking party triumphed. It was only a matter, it was true, of sums of 3 or 5 francs, but one of these petty penalties had to be paid by Julian's godfather, a nail-maker. In his anger, this man cried out, "What a turnaround! And to think for more than 20 years this justice of the peace passed for such a decent man." The surgeon major, Julian's friend, was dead. All at once Julian stopped talking about Napoleon. He announced his plan to become a priest and could constantly be seen in his father's sawmill, occupied in learning by heart the Latin Bible the cure had lent him. That good old man, marvelling at his progress, spent whole evenings teaching him theology. In front of him, Julian uttered nothing but pious sentiments. Who could have guessed that this girl-like visage, so pale and gentle, concealed an inextinguishable will to die 1,000 deaths rather than fail to make his fortune? For Julian to make his fortune meant, first of all, to get out of Verrieres. He abhorred the district where he was born. Everything that he saw there froze his imagination. From his earliest childhood he had experienced moments of rapture. Then he would dream with delight that he would one day encounter the beautiful women of Paris and would compel their attention by some famous deed. Why should he not be loved by one of them, as Bonaparte, while still poor, had been loved by the brilliant Mademoiselle de Beauharnais? For many years, scarcely an honour of Julian's life, hour of Julian's life, passed by without his telling himself that Bonaparte, an obscure and penniless lieutenant, had made himself master of the world with his sword. This idea consoled him for his sufferings, which he thought great, and redoubled his happiness when he had any. The construction of the church and the justice of the peace's judgments suddenly enlightened him. An idea came to him which made him distraught for some weeks, and seized hold of him with the overwhelming force belonging to the first idea with which a passionate nature believes itself to have been inspired. When Bonaparte made people talk about him, France was in danger of invasion. Military talent was necessary and fashionable. Today, one sees 40-year-old priests with stipends of 100,000 francs, that is to say, three times more than Julian's famous generals. They need people behind them to support them. Look at this justice of the peace, so sensible, such a fine, upstanding man, until now so established. Who has dishonoured himself for fear of offending a young clergyman of 30? It is necessary to be a priest. On one occasion, in the midst of this new piety, and after he had already been studying theology for 2 years, he was betrayed into a sudden eruption of the fire that consumed his soul. At Monsieur Chaland's dwelling, during a dinner for the clergy, to whom the good cure was presenting him a prodigy of tuition, he found himself fervidly praising Napoleon. He bound his right arm across his chest, pretending it had been dislocated in moving a pine trunk, and carried it in this irksome position for 2 months. After this bodily penance, he absolved himself. This was the young man of 19, but so seemingly frail that one could have taken him for no more than 17, who, carrying his little parcel under his arm, entered the magnificent church of Verrières. He found it sombre and solitary. To mark a festival, all the church windows had been covered with crimson cloth. The sun's rays shone through to produce a dim light, most pious and imposing. Julian shivered. Alone in the church, he established himself in the pew that had the finest appearance. It bore the arms of Monsieur de Renal. On the prayer desk, Julian noticed a fragment of printed paper spread out as though to be read. He directed his eyes towards it and saw details of the execution and the last moments of Louis Generel, executed at Besançon. The paper was torn off. On the other side could be seen the first words of a line which were the first step. "Who could have put this paper here?" said Julian. "Poor devil," he added with a sigh. "His name ends like mine," and he crumpled the paper. Leaving, Julian thought he saw blood next to the holy water stoop. It was holy water that had been spilled. The refraction from the red blinds covering the windows gave it the appearance of blood. Eventually Julian was ashamed of his secret terror. "Am I a coward?" he said to himself. "Two arms." This phrase, so often repeated in the Surgeon Major's accounts of battles, represented the heroic for Julian. He raised himself up and walked rapidly towards Monsieur de Renal's house. In spite of these fine resolves, from the moment he saw it, 20 paces away, he was seized with an overpowering timidity. The iron grill was open. To him it seemed magnificent, and it was up to him to enter it. Julian was not the only person whose feelings were disturbed by his arrival at the house. Mademoiselle de Renal's great sensitivity was upset by the idea of this stranger who, by the nature of his duties, would find himself constantly coming between her children and herself. She was used to having her sons sleep in her room. That morning, many tears had been shed as she saw their little beds being carried to the apartment destined for the tutor. In vain she had asked her husband that the bed of little Stanislas Xavier, the youngest, be brought back to her room. Feminine delicacy was pushed to an excess in Mademoiselle de Renal. She evoked for herself the most disagreeable image of a gross and ill-kempt being, empowered to scold her children solely because he knew Latin, a barbarous language for the sake of which her sons were to be chastised. All right, there we go. Another chapter done. Have your say on the subreddit. Thanks very much for listening, and I'll see you tomorrow.